the better. The gully dwarves would get what was, to them, more precious than all the pretty rocks in Kryn, a return to the sweet, halcyon days of freedom. And so, enough of this nonsense about sneaking around. Fudge leaned over and whispered in the guard's ear, "You go to Dragon. Give her best regards of His Majesty, High Bulp Fudge the First. And tell her."
Chapter 20. The High Bulp's Map. A Spellbook of Fist and Dantalus.
"I don't trust that little bastard any farther than I can stand the smell of him," Caraman growled.
"I agree," Tanis said quietly.
"But what choice do we have?
We've agreed to bring him the treasure. He has everything to lose and nothing to gain if he betrays us."
They sat on the floor of the waiting place, a filthy antechamber outside the throne room. The decorations in this room were just as vulgar as in the court. The companions were nervous and tense, speaking little and forcing themselves to eat. Raistlin refused food. Curled up on the floor apart from the others, he prepared and drank down the strange herbal mixture that eased his cough. Then he wrapped himself in his robes and stretched out, eyes closed, on the floor. Bupu sat curled up next to him, munching on something from her bag. Caraman, going over to check on his brother, was horrified to see a tail disappear into her mouth with a slurp. Riverwind sat by himself. He did not take part in the hushed conversation as the friends went over their plans once again. The plainsman stared moodily at the floor. When he felt a light touch on his arm, he didn't even lift his head. Gold Moon, her face pale, knelt beside him. She tried to speak, failed, then cleared her throat.
"We must talk,"
she said firmly in their language.
"Is that a command?"
he asked bitterly.
She swallowed. "Yes,"
she answered, barely audible. Riverwind rose to his feet and walked over to stand in front of a garish tapestry. He did not look at Gold Moon or even speak to her. His face was drawn into a stern mask, but underneath, Gold Moon could see the searing pain in his soul. She gently laid her hand on his arm.
"Forgive me,"
she said softly. Riverwind regarded her in astonishment. She stood before him, her head bowed, an almost childlike shame on her face. He reached out to stroke the silver-gold hair of the one he loved more than life itself. He felt Gold Moon tremble at his touch, and his heart ached with love. Moving his hand from her head to her neck, he very gently and tenderly drew the beloved head to his chest, and then suddenly clasped her in his arms.
"I've never heard you say those words before," he said, smiling to himself, knowing she could not see him. "I have never said them,"
she gulped, her cheek pressed against his leather shirt.
"Oh, my beloved, I am sorrier than I can say that you came home to Chieftain's daughter and not Gold Moon. But I've been so afraid."
"No,"
he whispered. "I am the one who should ask forgiveness."
He raised his hand to wipe away her tears.
"I didn't realize what you had gone through. All I could think of was myself and the dangers I had faced. I wish you had told me, heart's dearest."
"I wish you had asked,"
she replied, looking up at him earnestly.
"I have been Chieftain's daughter so long. It is the only thing I know how to be. It is my strength. It gives me courage when I am frightened. I don't think I can let go."
"I don't want you to let go." He smiled at her, smoothing wayward strands of hair from her face. "I fell in love with Chieftain's daughter the first time I saw you. Do you remember? At the games held in your honor. You refused to bow to receive my blessing," she said. "You acknowledged my father's leadership, but denied that I was a goddess. You said man could not make gods of other men." Her eyes looked back so many, many years. "How tall and proud and handsome you were, talking of ancient gods that did not exist to me then." "And how furious you were," he recalled. "And how beautiful. Your beauty was a blessing to me in itself. I needed no other. You wanted me thrown out of the games." Gold Moon smiled sadly. "You thought I was angry because you had shamed me before the people, but that was not so." "No? What was it then, Chieftain's daughter?" Her face flushed a dusky rose, but she lifted her clear blue eyes to him. "I was angry because I knew when I saw you standing there, refusing to kneel before me, that I had lost part of myself and that, until you claimed it, I would never be whole again." For reply, the plainsman pressed her to him, kissing her hair gently. "Riverwind," she said, swallowing. "Chieftain's daughter is still here. I don't think she can ever leave. But you must know that Gold Moon is underneath, and if this journey ever ends, and we come to peace at last, then Gold Moon will be yours forever, and we will banish Chieftain's daughter to the winds."
A thump at the High Bulb's door caused everyone to start nervously as a gully dwarf stumbled into the room.
"Map,"
he said, thrusting a crumbled piece of paper at Tanis.
"Thank you," said the half-elf gravely, "and extend our thanks to the High Bulb."
"His Majesty the High Bulb,"
the guard corrected with an anxious glance toward a tapestry-covered wall. Bobbing clumsily, he backed into the High Bulb's quarters. Tanis spread the map flat. Everyone gathered around it. Even Flint. After one look, however, the dwarf snorted derisively and walked back to his couch. Tanis laughed ruefully.
"We might have expected it. I wonder if this great fudge remembers where the big secret room is." "Of course not."
Raistlin sat up, opening his strange golden eyes and peering at them through half-closed lids.
"That is why he has never returned for the treasure. However, there is one among us who knows where the dragon's lair is located."
Everyone followed the mage's gaze. Boo-Poo glared back at them defiantly.
"You right, I know," she said, sulking. "I know secret place. I go there, find pretty rocks, but don't tell High Bulb."
"Will you tell us?" Tanis asked.
Boo-Poo looked at Raistlin. He nodded.
"I tell," she mumbled. "Give map."
Raistlin, seeing the others engrossed in looking at the map, beckoned to his brother.
"Is the plan still the same?"
the mage whispered.
"Yes."
Caraman frowned.
"And I don't like it. I should go with you."
"Nonsense,"
Raistlin hissed.
"You would only be in my way."
Then he added more gently,
"I will be in no danger, I assure you."
He laid his hand on his twin's arm and drew him close.
"Besides,"
the mage glanced around,
"there is something you must do for me, my brother. Something you must bring me from the dragon's lair."
Raistlin's touch was unusually hot. His eyes burned. Caraman uneasily started to pull back, seeing something in his brother he hadn't seen since the Towers of High Sorcery. But Raistlin's hand clutched at him.
"What is it?"
Caraman asked, reluctantly.
"A spell book,"
Raistlin whispered.
"So that is why you wanted to come to Zakhtzaroth,"
said Caraman.
"You knew this spell book would be here. I read about it years ago.
I knew it had been in Zaxxaroth prior to the cataclysm. All of the Order knew it, but we assumed it had been destroyed with the city. When I found out Zaxxaroth had escaped destruction, I realized there might be a chance the book had survived.
How do you know it's in the dragon's lair?
I don't. I am merely surmising. To magic users, this book is Zaxxaroth's greatest treasure. You may be certain that if the dragon found it, she is using it.
You want me to get it for you, Caramon said slowly.
What does it look like?
Like my spellbook, of course, except the bone-white parchment is bound in night-blue leather with runes of silver stamped on the front. It will feel deathly cold to the touch.
What do the runes say?
You do not want to know,
Raistlin whispered. Whose book was it? Caramon asked suspiciously.
Raistlin fell silent, his golden eyes abstracted, as if he were searching inwardly, trying to remember something forgotten.
You have never heard of him, my brother,
he said finally, in a whisper that forced Caramon to lean closer.
Yet he was one of the greatest of my order. His name was Fistandantalus.
The way you describe the spellbook...
Caramon hesitated, fearing what Raistlin would reply. He swallowed and started over.
This Fistandantalus, did he wear the black robes?
He could not meet his brother's piercing gaze.
Ask me no more,
Raistlin hissed.
You are as bad as the others. How can any of you understand me?
Seeing his twin's look of pain, the mage sighed.
Trust me, Caramon. It is not a particularly powerful spellbook. One of the mage's early books, in fact. One he had when he was very young indeed.
Raistlin murmured, staring far off. Then he blinked and said more briskly,
But it will be valuable to me nonetheless. You must get it. You must...
He started to cough.
Sure, Raist,
Caramon promised, soothing his brother.
Don't get worked up. I'll find it.
Good, Caramon. Excellent, Caramon,
Raistlin whispered when he could not speak. He sank back into the corner and closed his eyes.
Now let me rest. I must be ready.
Caramon stood up, looked at his brother a moment, then turned around and nearly fell over Boo-Poo, who was standing behind him, gazing up at him suspiciously with wide eyes.
What was all that about?
Sturm asked gruffly as Caramon returned to the group.
Oh, nothing,
the big man mumbled, flushing guiltily. Sturm cast an alarmed glance at Tanis.
What is it, Caramon?
Tanis asked, putting the rolled map in his belt and facing the warrior. Anything wrong?
No,
Caramon stuttered.
It's nothing. I tried to get Raistlin to let me go with him. He said I'd just be in the way.
Tanis studied Caramon. He knew the big man was telling the truth, but Tanis also knew the warrior wasn't telling all the truth. Caramon would cheerfully shed the last drop of his blood for any member of the company. But Tanis suspected he would betray them all at Raistlin's command. The giant looked at Tanis, silently begging him to ask no more questions.
He's right, you know, Caramon,
Tanis said finally, clapping the big man on the arm. Raistlin won't be in danger. Boo-Poo will be with him. She'll bring him back here to hide. He's just got to conjure up some of his fancy pyrotechnics, create a diversion to draw the dragon away from her lair. He'll be long gone by the time she gets there.
Sure, I know that,
said Caramon, forcing a chuckle.
You need me anyway.
We do,
Tanis said seriously.
Now, is everyone ready?
Silently, grimly, they stood up. Raistlin rose and came forward, hood over his face, hands folded in his robes. There was an aura around the mage, indefinable yet frightening. The aura of power, derived and created from within. Tanis cleared his throat. "We'll give you a 500 count," Tanis said to Raistlin. "Then we'll start. The secret place marked on the map is a trapdoor located in a building not far from here, according to your little friend. It leads beneath the city to a tunnel that comes up under the dragon's lair, near where we saw her today. Create your diversion in the plaza, then come back here. We'll meet here, give the high bulb his treasure, and lie low until night. When it's dark, we'll escape."
"I understand,"
Raistlin said calmly. "I wish I did," Tanis thought bitterly. "I wish I understood what was going on in that mind of yours, mage." But the half-elf said nothing.
"We go now?"
asked Bupu, looking at Tanis anxiously. "We go now," Tanis said. Raistlin crept from the shadowy alley and moved swiftly down the street to the south. He saw no signs of life. It was as if all the gully dwarves had been swallowed up by the mist. He found this thought disturbing and kept to the shadows. The frail mage could move silently if there was need. He only hoped he could control his coughing. The pain and congestion in his chest had eased when he drank the herbal mixture, whose recipe had been given him by Parsalian. A kind of apology from the great sorcerer for the trauma the young mage had endured. But the mixture's effect would soon wear off. Bupu peered out from behind his robes, her beady black eyes squinting down the street leading east to the great plaza.
"No one,"
she said, and tugged on the mage's robe.
"We go now."
"No one," thought Raistlin, worried. It didn't make sense. Where were the crowds of gully dwarves? He had the feeling something had gone wrong, but there wasn't time to turn back. Tanis and the others were on their way to the secret tunnel entrance. The mage smiled bitterly. What a fool's quest this was turning out to be. They would probably all die in this wretched city. Bupu tugged on his robe again. Shrugging, he cast his hood over his head, and together he and the gully dwarf flitted down the mist-shrouded street. Two armor-clad figures detached themselves from a dark doorway and slunk quickly after Raistlin and Bupu. "This is the place," Tanis said softly. Opening a rotting door, he peered in. "It's dark in here. We'll need a light." There was a sound of flint striking metal, and then a flare of light as Karamin lit one of the torches they had borrowed from the high bulb. The warrior handed one to Tanis and lit one for himself and Riverwind. Tanis stepped inside the building and immediately found himself up to his ankles in water. Holding the torch aloft, he saw water pouring in steady streams down the walls of the dismal room. It swirled around the center of the floor, then ran out through cracks around the edges. Tanis sloshed to the center and held his torch close to the water. "There it is. I can see it," he said as the others waded into the room. He pointed to a trap door in the floor. An iron pull ring was barely visible in its center. "Karamin." Tanis stood back.
"Pah!" Flint snorted. "If a gully dwarf can open this, I can open it. Stand aside."
The dwarf elbowed everyone back, plunged his hand into the water, and heaved. There was a moment's silence. Flint grunted, his face turned red. He stopped, straightened up with a gasp, then reached down and tried again. There wasn't a creak. The door remained shut. Tanis put his hand on the dwarf's shoulder. "Flint, Bupu says she only goes down during the dry season. You're trying to lift half of New Sea along with the door."
"Well,"
the dwarf puffed for breath,
"why didn't you say so? Let the big ox try his luck."
Caraman stepped forward. He reached down into the water and gave a heave. His shoulder muscles bulged, and veins in his neck stood out. There was a sucking sound. Then the suction was released so suddenly that the big warrior nearly fell over backward. Water drained from the room as Caraman eased the wooden plank door over. Tanis held his torch down to see. A 4-foot square shaft gaped in the floor. A narrow iron ladder descended into the shaft.
"What's the count?"
Tanis asked, his throat dry.
403, answered Sturm's deep voice, 404.
The companions stood around the trap door, shivering in the chill air, hearing nothing but the sound of water pouring down the shaft.
451,
noted the knight calmly. Tanis scratched his beard. Caraman coughed twice, as though reminding them of his absent brother. Flint fidgeted and dropped his axe in the water. Tass absent-mindedly chewed on the end of his topknot. Gold Moon, pale but composed, drew near Riverwind, the nondescript brown staff in her hand. He put his arm around her. Nothing was worse than waiting.
500,
said Sturm finally.
About time!
Tasselhoff swung himself down onto the ladder. Tanis went next, holding his torch to light the way for Gold Moon, who came after him. The others followed, climbing slowly down into an access shaft of the city sewage system. The shaft ran about 20 feet straight down, then opened up into a 5-foot-wide tunnel that ran north and south.
Check the depth of the water,
Tanis warned the Kender as Tass was about to let go of the ladder. The Kender, hanging onto the last rung with one hand, lowered his hoopak staff into the dark, swirling water before him. The staff sank about halfway.
2 feet,
said Tass cheerfully. He dropped in with a splash, the water hitting him around the thighs. He looked up at Tanis inquiringly.
That way,
Tanis pointed, south.
Holding his staff in the air, Tasselhoff let the current sweep him along.
"Where's that diversion?"
Sturm asked, his voice echoing. Tanis had been wondering that himself.
"We probably won't be able to hear anything down here."
He hoped that was true.
"Raist'll come through, don't worry," Caraman said grimly.
"Tanis!"
Tasselhoff fell back into the half-elf.
"There's something down here! I felt it go by my feet."
"Just keep moving," Tanis muttered, "and hope it isn't hungry."
They waded on in silence, the torchlight flickering off the walls, creating illusions in the mind's eye. More than once, Tanis saw something reach out for him, only to realize it was the shadow cast by Caraman's helm or Tass's hoop. The tunnel ran straight south for about 200 feet, then turned east. The companions stopped. Down the eastern arm of the sewer glimmered a column of dim light filtering from above. This, according to Boo Poo, marked the dragon's lair.
"Douse the torches,"
Tanis hissed, plunging his torch in the water. Touching the slimy wall, Tanis followed the Kender, Tass's red outline showing up vividly to his elven eyes through the tunnel. Behind him, he heard Flint complaining about the effects of water on his rheumatism.
"Shh," Tanis whispered, as they drew near the light.
Trying to be silent in spite of clanking armor, they soon stood by a slender ladder that ran up to an iron grating.
"No one ever bothers to lock floor gratings."
Tass pulled Tanis close to whisper in his ear.
"But I'm sure I can open it if it is."
Tanis nodded. He didn't add that Boo Poo had been able to open it as well. The art of picking locks was as much a matter of pride to the Kender as Sturm's mustaches were to the knight. They all stood, watching, knee-deep in water, as Tass skimmed up the ladder.
"I still don't hear anything outside,"
Sturm muttered.
"Shh!"
Karaman growled harshly. The grating had a lock, a simple one that Tass opened in moments. Then he silently lifted the grating and peered out. Sudden darkness descended on him, darkness so thick and impenetrable it seemed to hit him like a lead weight, nearly making him lose his hold on the grating. Hurriedly, he put the grating back into place without making a sound, then slid down the ladder, bumping into Tanis.
Tass?
The half-elf grabbed him.
Is that you? I can't see. What's going on?
I don't know. It just got dark all of a sudden.
What do you mean you can't see?
Sturm whispered to Tanis.
What about your elf talent?
Gone, Tanis said grimly.
Just as in darkened wood. And out by the well.
No one spoke as they stood huddled in the tunnel. All they could hear was the sound of their own breathing and water dripping from the wells. The dragon was up there, waiting for them.
Chapter 21 The Sacrifice The Twice-Dead City. Despair, blacker than the darkness, blinded Tanis.
It was my plan. The only way we had a chance to get out of here alive, he thought. It was sound. It should have worked. What went wrong? Raistlin, could he have betrayed us? No.
Tanis clenched his fist.
No, damn it.
The mage was distant, unlikable, impossible to understand, yes, but he was loyal to them. Tanis would swear it.
Where was Raistlin?
Dead, perhaps. Not that it mattered. They would all be dead. Tanis. The half-elf felt a firm grasp on his arm and recognized Sturm's deep voice.
I know what you're thinking. We have no choice. We're running out of time. This is our only chance to get the discs. We won't get another.
I'm going to look, Tanis said.
He climbed past the kender and peered through the grate. It was dark. Magically dark. Tanis put his head in his hand and tried to think. Sturm was right. Time was running out. Yet how could he trust the knight's judgment? Sturm wanted to fight the dragon. Tanis crawled back down the ladder.
We're going, he said.
Suddenly, all he wanted to do was get this over with. Then they could go home. Home to Solace.
No, Tass.
He grabbed hold of the kender and dragged him back down the ladder. The fighters go first. Sturm and Karaman. Then the rest. But the knight was already shoving past him eagerly, his sword clanking against his thigh.
We're always last,
Tasselhoff sniffed, shoving the dwarf along. Flint climbed the ladder slowly, his knees creaking.
Hurry up,
Tass said.
I hope nothing happens before we get there. I've never talked to a dragon.
I'll bet the dragons never talk to a kender either,
the dwarf snorted.
You realize, you harebrained, that we're probably going to die. Tanis knows. I could tell by his voice.
Tass paused, clinging to the ladder, while Sturm slowly pushed on the grating.
You know, Flint,
the kender said seriously,
my people don't fear death. In a way, we look forward to it, the last big adventure. But I think I'd feel badly about leaving this life. I'd miss my things.
He patted his pouches.
And my maps, and you, and Tanis. Unless, he added brightly, we all go to the same place when we die.
Flint had a sudden vision of the happy-go-lucky kender lying cold and dead. He felt a lump of pain in his chest and was thankful for the concealing darkness. Clearing his throat, he said huskily,
If you think I'm going to share my afterlife with a bunch of kender, you're crazier than Raistlin. Come on!
Sturm carefully lifted the grating and shoved it to one side.
It scraped over the floor, causing him to grit his teeth. He heaved himself up easily. Turning, he bent down to help Caraman, who was having trouble squeezing his body and his clanking arsenal through the shaft.
"In the name of Istar, be quiet!"
Sturm hissed.
"I'm trying,"
Caraman muttered, finally climbing over the edge. Sturm gave his hand to Gold Moon. Last came Tass, delighted that nobody had done anything exciting in his absence.
"We've got to have light,"
Sturm said.
"Light?"
replied a voice as cold and dark as winter midnight.
"Yes. Let us have light."
The darkness fled instantly. The companions saw they were in a huge domed chamber that soared hundreds of feet into the air. Cold gray light filtered into the room through a crack in the ceiling, shining on a large altar in the center of the circular room. On the floor surrounding the altar were masses of jewels, coins, and other treasures of the dead city. The jewels did not gleam. The gold did not glitter. The dim light illuminated nothing, nothing except a black dragon perched on top of the pedestal like some huge beast of prey. "Feeling betrayed?" the dragon asked in conversational tones.
"The mage betrayed us. Where is he? Serving you?"
Sturm cried fiercely, drawing his sword and taking a step forward.
"Stand back, foul knight of Solamnia. Stand back, or your magic user will use his magic no more."
The dragon snaked her great neck down and stared at them with gleaming red eyes. Then, slowly and delicately, she lifted one clawed foot. Lying beneath it, on the pedestal, was Raistlin.
"Raist!"
Caraman roared and lunged for the altar.
"Stop, fool!"
the dragon hissed. She rested one pointed claw lightly on the mage's abdomen. With a great effort, Raistlin moved his head to look at his brother with his strange golden eyes. He made a weak gesture and Caraman halted. Tanis saw something move on the floor beneath the altar. It was Bupu, huddled among the riches, too afraid even to whimper. The staff of Magius lay next to her.
"Move one step closer, and I will impale this shriveled human upon the altar with my claw."
Caraman's face flushed a deep, ugly red.
"Let him go!"
he shouted.
"Your fight is with me!"
"My fight is with none of you,"
the dragon said, lazily moving its wings. Raistlin flinched as the dragon's clawed foot shifted slightly, teasingly, digging her claw into his flesh. The mage's metallic skin glistened with sweat. He drew a deep, ragged breath.
"Don't even twitch, mage."
The dragon sneered.
"We speak the same language, remember? One word of a spell and your friends' carcasses will be used to feed the gully dwarves."
Raistlin's eyes closed as in exhaustion. But Tanis could see the mage's hands clench and unclench, and he knew Raistlin was preparing one final spell. It would be his last. By the time he cast it, the dragon would kill him. But it might give Riverwind a chance to reach the disks and get out alive with Gold Moon. Tanis edged toward the plainsman.
"As I was saying," the dragon continued smoothly, "I do not choose to fight any of you. How you have escaped my wrath so far, I do not understand. Still, you are here. And you return to me that which was stolen. Yes, Lady of Guishu. I see you hold the blue crystal staff. Bring it to me."
Tanis hissed one word to Gold Moon. "Stall." But, looking at her cool marble face, he wondered if she heard him,
or if she even heard the dragon. She seemed to be listening to other words, other voices. "Obey me." The dragon lowered her head, menacingly. "Obey me, or the mage dies. And after him, the knight, and then the half-elf, and so on, one after the other, until you, Lady of Kuei Shu, are the last survivor. Then you will bring me the staff, and you will beg me to be merciful." Gold Moon bowed her head in submission, gently pushing Riverwind away with her hand. She turned to Tanis and clasped the half-elf in a loving embrace.
"Farewell, my friend,"
she said loudly, laying her cheek against his. Her voice dropped to a whisper.
"I know what I must do. I am going to take the staff to the dragon and—"
"No," Tanis said fiercely. "It won't matter. The dragon intends to kill us anyway."
"Listen to me."
Gold Moon's nails dug into Tanis's arm.
"Stay with Riverwind, Tanis. Do not let him try to stop me. And if I tried to stop you?"
Tanis asked gently, holding Gold Moon close in his arms.
"You won't," she said with a sweet, sad smile. "You know that each of us has a destiny to fulfill, as the Forest Master said. Riverwind will need you. Farewell, my friend."
Gold Moon stepped back, her clear blue eyes on Riverwind as though she would memorize every detail to keep with her throughout eternity. Realizing she was saying goodbye, he started to go to her.
"Riverwind," Tanis said softly, "trust her. She trusted you all those years. She waited while you fought the battles. Now it is you who must wait. This is her battle."
Riverwind trembled, then stood still. Tanis could see the veins swell in his neck, his jaw muscles clench. The half-elf gripped the plainsman's arm. The tall man didn't even look at him. His eyes were on Gold Moon.
"What is this delay?" the dragon asked. "I grow bored. Come forward."
Gold Moon turned away from Riverwind. She walked past Flint and Tasselhoff. The dwarf bowed his head.
Tass watched, wide-eyed and solemn. Somehow this wasn't as exciting as he had imagined.
For the first time in his life, the Kender felt small and helpless, and alone. It was a horrible, unpleasant feeling, and he thought death might be preferable. Gold Moon stopped near Karaman, put her hand on his arm.
"Don't worry," she said to the big warrior,
who was staring at his brother in agony.
"He'll be all right."
Karaman choked and nodded. And then Gold Moon neared Sturm. Suddenly, as if the horror of the dragon was too overwhelming, she slumped forward. The knight caught her and held her.
"Come with me, Sturm,"
Gold Moon whispered as he put his arm around her.
"You must vow to do as I command, no matter what happens. Vow on your honor as a knight of Salamnia."
Sturm hesitated. Gold Moon's eyes, calm and clear, met his.
"Vow,"
she demanded,
"or I go alone."
"I vow, lady," he said reverently. "I will obey."
Gold Moon sighed thankfully.
"Walk with me. Make no threatening gesture."
Together, the barbarian woman of the plains and the knight walked toward the dragon. Raistlin lay beneath the dragon's claw, his eyes closed, preparing himself mentally for the spell that would be his last. But the words to the spell would not form out of the turmoil of his mind. He fought to regain control.
"I am wasting myself, and for what?"
Raistlin wondered bitterly.
"To get these fools out of the mess they got themselves into. They will not attack for fear of hurting me, even though they fear and despise me. It makes no sense. Just as my sacrifice makes no sense. Why am I dying for them when I deserve to live more than they?"
"It is not for them you do this,"
a voice answered him. Raistlin started, trying to concentrate, to catch hold of the voice. It was a real voice, a familiar voice, but he couldn't remember whose it was or where he had heard it. All he knew was that it spoke to him in moments of great stress. The closer to death he came, the louder was the voice. "It is not for them that you make this sacrifice," the voice repeated. "It is because you cannot bear defeat. Nothing has ever defeated you, not even death itself." Raistlin drew a deep breath and relaxed. He did not understand the words completely, just as he could not remember the voice. But now the spell came easily to his mind.
"Astolarakum,"
he murmured, feeling the magic begin to course through his frail body. Then another voice broke his concentration, and this voice was a living voice, speaking to his mind. He opened his eyes, turned his head slowly, and stared into the chamber at his companions. The voice came from the woman, barbarian princess of a dead tribe. Raistlin looked at Gold Moon as she walked toward him, leaning on Sturm's arm. The words in her mind had touched Raistlin's mind. He regarded the woman coldly, detachedly. His distorted vision had forever killed any physical desire the mage might have felt when he looked upon human flesh. He could not see the beauty that so captivated Tanis and his brother. His hourglass eyes saw her withering and dying. He felt no closeness, no compassion for her. He knew she pitied him, and he hated her for that. But she feared him as well, so why then was she speaking to him? She was telling him to wait. Raistlin understood. She knew what he intended, and she was telling him it wasn't necessary. She had been chosen. She was the one who was going to make the sacrifice. He watched Gold Moon with his strange golden eyes as she drew nearer and nearer, her own eyes on the dragon. He saw Sturm moving solemnly beside her, looking as ancient and noble as old Huma himself. What a perfect cat's paw Sturm made, the ideal participant in Gold Moon's sacrifice. But why had Riverwind allowed her to go? Couldn't he see this coming? Raistlin glanced quickly at Riverwind. Ah, of course. The half-elf stood by his side, looking pained and grieved, dropping words of wisdom, like blood, no doubt. The barbarian was becoming as gullible as Caramon. Raistlin flicked his eyes back to Gold Moon. She stood before the dragon now, her face pale with resolve. Next to her, Sturm appeared grave and tortured, gnawed by inner conflict. Gold Moon had probably extracted some vow of strict obedience which the knight was honor-bound to fulfill. Raistlin's lip curled in a sneer. The dragon spoke, and the mage tensed, ready for action. "Lay down the staff with the other remnants of mankind's folly," the dragon commanded Gold Moon, inclining her shining, scaled head toward the pile of treasure below the altar. Gold Moon, overcome with dragon fear, did not move. She could do nothing but stare at the monstrous creature, trembling. Sturm, next to her, searched the treasure trove with his eyes, looking for the disks of Mishikal, fighting to control his fear of the dragon. Sturm had not known he could be this frightened of anything. He repeated the code, "Honor is life," over and over, and he knew it was pride alone that kept him from running away. Gold Moon saw Sturm's hand shake. She saw the knight's face glisten with sweat. "Dear goddess," she cried in her soul, "grant me the courage." Then Sturm nudged her. She had to say something, she realized. She had been silent too long. "What will you give us in return for the miraculous staff?" Gold Moon asked, forcing herself to speak calmly, though her throat was parched and her tongue felt swollen. The dragon laughed, shrill, ugly laughter. What will I give you? The dragon snaked her head to stare at Gold Moon. Nothing. Nothing at all. I do not deal with thieves. Still, the dragon reared its head back, its red eyes closed to slits. Playfully, she dug her claw into Raistlin's flesh. The mage flinched, but he bore the pain without a murmur. The dragon removed the claw and held it just high enough so that they could all see the blood drip from it. It is not inconceivable that Lord Verminard, the Dragon High Master, may view favorably the fact that you surrender the staff. He may even be inclined to mercy. He is a cleric, and they have strange values. But know this, Lady of Kuei Xiu, Lord Verminard does not need your friends. Give up the staff now, and they will be spared. Force me to take it, and they will die. The mage, first of all. Gold Moon, her spirit seemingly broken, slumped in defeat. Sturm moved close to her, appearing to console her. I have found the discs, he whispered harshly. He grasped her arm, feeling her shivering with fear. Are you resolved on this course of action, my lady? He said softly. Gold Moon bowed her head. She was deathly pale, but composed and calm. Tendrils of her fine, silver-golden hair had escaped from the binding and fell around her face, hiding her expression from the dragon. Though she appeared defeated, she looked up at Sturm and smiled. There was both peace and sorrow in her smile, much like the smile on the marble goddess. She did not speak, but Sturm had his answer. He bowed in submission. May my courage be equal to yours, lady, he said. I will not fail you. Farewell, knight. Tell Riverwind. Gold Moon faltered, blinking her eyes as tears filled them. Fearing her resolve might yet break, she swallowed her words and turned to face the dragon, as the voice of Mishikal filled her being, answering her prayer. Present the staff boldly. Gold Moon, imbued with an inner strength, raised the blue crystal staff. We do not choose to surrender! Gold Moon shouted, her voice echoing throughout the chamber. Moving swiftly, before the startled dragon could react, Chieftain's daughter swung her staff one last time, striking the clawed foot poised above Raistlin. The staff made a low, ringing sound as it struck the dragon. Then it shattered. A burst of pure, radiant blue light beamed from the broken staff. The light grew brighter, spreading out in concentric waves, engulfing the dragon. Kisanth screamed in rage. The dragon was injured, terribly, mortally. She lashed out with her tail, flung her head about, and fought to escape the burning blue flame. She wanted nothing except to kill those that dared inflict such pain, but the intense blue fire relentlessly consumed her, as it consumed Gold Moon. The chieftain's daughter had not dropped the staff when it shattered. She held on to the fragmented end, watching as the light grew, keeping it as close to the dragon as she could. When the blue light touched her hands, she felt intense, burning pain. Staggering, she fell to her knees, still clutching the staff. She heard the dragon shrieking and roaring above her. Then she could hear nothing but the ringing of the staff. The pain grew so horrible it was no longer a part of her, and she was overcome with a great weariness. I will sleep, she thought. I will sleep. And when I waken, I will be where I truly belong.
Sturm saw the blue light slowly destroy the dragon. Then it spread along the staff to Gold Moon. He heard the ringing sound grow louder and louder until it drowned out even the screams of the dying dragon.
Sturm took a step toward Gold Moon, thinking to wrench the splintered staff from her hand and drag her clear of the deadly blue flame, but even as he approached, he knew he could not save her. Half-blinded by the light and deafened by the sound, the knight realized that it would take all his strength and courage to fulfill his oath, to retrieve the discs. He tore his gaze from Gold Moon, whose face was twisted in agony and whose flesh was withering in the fire. Gritting his teeth against the pain in his head, he staggered toward the treasure pile, where he had seen the discs, hundreds of thin sheets of platinum bound together by a single ring through the top. Reaching down, he lifted them, amazed at their lightness. Then his heart almost stopped beating, when a bloody hand reached up from the pile of treasure and grasped his wrist.
"Help me!"
He could not hear the voice, so much as sense the thought. Grasping Raistlin's hand, he pulled the mage to his feet. Blood was visible through the red of Raistlin's robe, but he did not appear to be seriously injured. At least he could stand. But could he walk? Sturm needed help. He wondered where the others were. He couldn't see them in the brilliance. Suddenly, Caramon loomed by his side, his armor gleaming in the blue flame. Raistlin clutched at him.
"Help me find the spellbook!"
he hissed.
"Who cares about that?"
Caramon roared, reaching for his brother.
"I'll get you out of here!"
Raistlin's mouth twisted so in fury and frustration that he could not speak. He dropped to his knees and began to search frantically through the pile of treasure. Caramon tried to draw him away, but Raistlin shoved him back with his frail hand. And still, the ringing sound pierced their ears. Sturm felt tears of pain trickle down his cheeks. Suddenly, something crashed to the floor in front of the knight. The chamber ceiling was collapsing. The entire building shook around them, the ringing sound causing the pillars to tremble and the walls to crack. Then the ringing died, and with it, the dragon. Kisanth had vanished, leaving behind nothing but a pile of smoldering ash. Sturm gasped in relief, but not for long. As soon as the ringing sound ended, he could hear the sounds of the palace caving in, the cracking of the ceiling and the thuds and explosive crashes of huge stone slabs struck the floor. Then, out of the dust and noise, Tanis appeared before him. Blood trickled from a cut on the half-elf's cheek. Sturm grabbed his friend and pulled him to the altar as another chunk of ceiling plummeted near them.
"The whole city is collapsing!" Sturm yelled. "How do we get out?"
Tanis shook his head.
"The only way I know is back the way we came, through that tunnel," he shouted.
He ducked as another piece of ceiling crashed onto the empty altar.
"That'll be a death trap. There must be another way."
"We'll find it,"
Tanis said firmly. He peered through the billowing dust.
"Where are the others?"
he asked. Then, turning, he saw Raistlin and Caramon. Tanis stared in horror and disgust at the mage scavenging among the treasure. Then he saw a small figure tugging Raistlin's sleeve.
Bupu!
Tanis made a lunge for her, nearly scaring the gully dwarf witless. She shrank back against Raistlin with a startled scream.
"We've got to get out of here!"
Tanis roared. He grabbed hold of Raistlin's robes and dragged the slender young man to his feet.
"Stop looting and get that gully dwarf of yours to show us the way out, or so help me, you'll die by my hands."
Raistlin's thin lips parted in a ghastly smile as Tanis flung him back against the altar.
Bupu shrieked, "Come, we go, on no way."
"Raist," Caramon begged. "You can't find it. You'll die if we don't get out of here."
"Very well," the mage snarled.
He lifted the staff of Magius from the altar and stood up, reaching out his arm for his brother's aid.
"Bupu, show us the way,"
he commanded.
"Raistlin, light your staff so we can follow you,"
Tanis ordered.
"I'm going to find the others."
"Over there,"
Caramon said grimly.
"You're going to need help with the plainsmen."
Tanis flung his arm over his face as more stone fell, then jumped across the rubble. He found Riverwind collapsed where Gold Moon had been standing, Flint and Tasselhoff trying to get the plainsman to his feet. There was nothing there now, except a large area of blackened stone. Gold Moon had been totally consumed in the flames.
"Is he alive?"
Tanis shouted.
"Yes,"
Tass answered, his voice carrying shrilly above the noise.
"But he won't move."
"I'll talk to him," Tanis said. "Follow the others. We'll be there in a moment. Go on."
Tasselhoff hesitated, but Flint, after a glance at Tanis's face, put his hand on the Kender's arm. Snuffling, Tass turned and began running through the rubble with the dwarf. Tanis knelt beside Riverwind. Then the half-elf glanced up as Sturm appeared out of the gloom.
"Go on," Tanis said. "You're in command now."
Sturm hesitated. A column toppled over near them, showering them in rock dust. Tanis flung his body across Riverwind's.
"Go on,"
he yelled at Sturm.
"I'm holding you responsible."
Sturm drew a breath, laid a hand on Tanis's shoulder, then ran toward the light from Raistlin's staff. The knight found the others huddled in a narrow hallway. The arched ceiling above them seemed to be holding together, but Sturm could hear thudding sounds above. The ground shook beneath their feet, and little rivulets of water were beginning to seep through new cracks in the walls.
"Where's Tanis?" Caraman asked.
"He'll be along," Sturm said harshly. "We'll wait. A few moments at least."
He did not mention that he would wait until waiting had dissolved into death. There was a shattering crack. Water began to gush through the wall, flooding the floor. Sturm was about to order the others out when a figure emerged from the collapsing doorway. It was Riverwind, carrying Tanis's inert body in his arms.
"What happened?"
Sturm leaped forward, his throat constricting.
"He's not..."
"He stayed with me," Riverwind said softly. "I told him to leave. I wanted to die, there with her. Then, a slab of stone. He never saw it."
"I'll carry him,"
Caraman said.
"No!"
Riverwind glared at the big warrior. His arms gripped Tanis's body tighter.
"I will carry him. We must go."
"Yes, this way. We go now," urged the gully dwarf.
She led them out of the city that was dying a second time. They emerged from the dragon's lair into the plaza, which was rapidly being submerged as new sea poured into the crumbling cavern. The companions waded across, holding on to each other to keep from being swept away in the vicious current. Howling gully dwarves swarmed everywhere in a state of wild confusion, some getting caught in the current, others climbing up into the top stories of shaking buildings, still others dashing down the streets. Sturm could think of only one way out.
"Go east,"
he shouted, gesturing down the broad street that led to the waterfall. He looked anxiously at Riverwind. The dazed plainsman seemed oblivious to the commotion around him. Tanis was unconscious, maybe dead. Fear chilled Sturm's blood, but he forcibly suppressed all emotions. The knight ran ahead, catching up with the twins.
"Our only chance is the lift,"
he yelled. Caraman nodded slowly.
"It will mean a fight." "Yes, damn it,"
said Sturm in exasperation, envisioning all of the Draconians trying to leave this stricken city.
"It will mean a fight. You got any better ideas?"
Caraman shook his head. At a corner, Sturm waited to herd his limping, exhausted band in the right direction. Peering through the dust and mist, he could see the lift ahead of them. It was, as he had foreseen, surrounded by a dark, writhing mass of Draconians. Fortunately, they were all intent on escape. They had to strike quickly, Sturm knew, to catch the creatures off guard. Timing was critical. He caught hold of the kender as Tass scurried past.
"Tass!" he yelled. "We're going up the lift!"
Tasselhoff nodded to show he understood, then made a face to imitate a draconian and slashed his hand across his throat.
"When we get near," Sturm shouted, "sneak around to where you can see the pot descending. When it starts to come down, signal me. We'll attack when it reaches the ground."
Tasselhoff's top knot bobbed.
"Tell Flint,"
Sturm finished, his voice nearly gone from shouting. Tass nodded again and raced off to find the dwarf. Sturm straightened his aching back with a sigh and continued on down the street. He could see about 20 or 25 draconians gathered in the courtyard, watching for the pot that would carry them to safety to begin its descent. Sturm imagined the confusion up on the top, draconians whipping and bullying the panic-stricken gully dwarves, forcing them into the lift. He hoped the confusion would last. Sturm saw the brothers in the shadow at the edge of the courtyard. He joined them, glancing up nervously as a stone slab crashed down behind him. As Riverwind staggered out of the mist and dust, Sturm started to help him, but the plainsman looked at the knight as if he had never seen him before in his life.
"Bring Tanis over here," Sturm said. "You can lay him down and rest a moment. We're going up in the lift, and we'll have a fight on our hands. Wait here. When we signal, do what you must."
Riverwind interrupted coldly. He laid Tanis's body gently on the ground and slumped down beside him, burying his face in his hands. Sturm hesitated. He started to kneel down by Tanis as Flint came to stand by his side.
"Go on, I'll check on him," the dwarf offered.
Sturm nodded thankfully. He saw Tasselhoff skitter across the courtyard and into a doorway. Looking toward the lift, he saw the draconians yelling and cursing into the mist as if they could hurry the pot's descent. Flint poked Sturm in the ribs.
"How are we going to fight all of them?"
he shouted.
"We're not. You're going to stay here with Riverwind and Tanis," Sturm said. "Caramon and I can handle this," he added,
wishing he believed it himself.
"And I," whispered the mage, "I still have my spells."
The knight did not answer. He distrusted magic and he distrusted Raistlin. Still, he had no choice. Caramon would not go into battle without his brother by his side. Tugging at his mustaches, Sturm restlessly loosened his sword. Caramon flexed his arms, clenching and unclenching his huge hands. Raistlin, his eyes closed, was lost in concentration. Bupu, hidden in a niche in the wall behind him, watched everything with wide, frightened eyes. The pot swung into view, gully dwarves hanging from its sides. As Sturm hoped, the draconians on the ground began to fight among themselves, none wanting to be left behind. Their panic increased as great cracks ran through the pavement toward them. Water rose through the cracks. The city of Zaktzaroth would soon be lying at the bottom of New Sea. As the pot touched ground, the gully dwarves scurried over the sides and fled. The draconians clambered in, hitting and shoving each other.
"Now!"
the knight yelled.
"Get out of my way!"
the mage hissed. Pulling a handful of sand from one of his pockets, he sprinkled it on the ground and whispered,
"Ast tasark, sinoralan krina,"
moving his right hand in an arc in the direction of the draconians. First one, then a few more blinked their eyes and slumped to the ground in sleep. But others remained standing, glancing around in alarm. The mage ducked back into the doorway and, seeing nothing, the draconians turned back to the lift, stepping on the bodies of their sleeping comrades in their frantic rush. Raistlin leaned against the wall, closing his eyes wearily.
"How many?"
he asked.
"Only about 6.
Caraman drew his sword from his sheath.
"Just get in the damn pot," Sturm yelled. "We'll come back for Tanis when the fight's ended."
Under cover of the mist, the two warriors, swords drawn, covered the distance to the Draconians within a few heartbeats, Raistlin stumbling behind. Sturm shouted his battle cry. At the sound, the Draconians spun around in alarm, and Riverwind raised his head. The sound of battle penetrated Riverwind's fog of despair. The plainsman saw Gold Moon before him, dying in the blue flame. The dead expression left his face, replaced by a ferocity so bestial and terrifying that Boo-Poo, still hiding in the doorway, screamed in alarm. Riverwind leaped to his feet. He didn't even draw his sword, but charged forward, empty-handed. He tore into the ranks of the scrambling Draconians like a starving panther and began to kill. He killed with his bare hands, twisting, choking, gouging. Draconians stabbed at him with their swords. Soon his leather tunic was soaked with blood, yet he never stopped moving among them, never stopped killing. His face was that of a madman. The Draconians in Riverwind's path saw death in his eyes, and they also saw that their weapons had no effect. One broke and ran, and soon another. Sturm, finishing an opponent, looked up grimly, prepared to find